Inspiring interviews with today's top landlords.
This is the Rental Income Podcast.
And now, Dan Lane.
Joining me on the podcast today from Chicago is Kirby Atwell. And Kirby built his portfolio while he was in the Army, or I guess he started building his portfolio when he was in the Army. I want to hear how he built his portfolio and what he's doing today. Kirby, welcome to the show.
Hey, Dan, I really appreciate you having me on here.
Yeah. So tell me how you got started. So you were in the Army and how did you just decide that you wanted to buy rentals, or how did you get started?
Yeah, I have slightly different story probably than a lot of people, but it's the same in some ways, I think, because I went to West Point Military Academy, and I was stationed down in El Paso, Texas, right afterwards. After you go to West Point, you got to serve as an officer for 5 years at a minimum to pay it back. So my first duty station was down in El Paso, and I picked up the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad as soon as I got out of school. And it kind of blew my mind, just, you know, the different thought process. I thought, you know, I'd gone through a lot of schooling, and I thought I kind of understood how to think about finance and money. And it just changed the way I thought about it. And I really became addicted to real estate right from the start. So I figured, you know, I could pick up some rentals now, you know, at being a recent college grad, and, you know, in 30 years, they're going to be paid off. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be my retirement. And so I didn't really have any other training other than just reading that book. And I went across the street. This was in 2006. So as you know, the market was pretty hot and heavy at that time.
Right.
Luckily, I was in El Paso, which is a very stable market. It doesn't go up very much and doesn't go down very much. So I went across the street. There's a house that was just listed. I told him I'd like to buy it and basically paid asking price. And it was right around $100,000 for the house. And so, you know, it wasn't my best investment ever, but it's a very stable rental that doesn't really cash flow much. But it over time, it's just being paid down, and I have a great property manager. And so that was the first one. And then I bought another one there in El Paso, and then I got stationed in Hawaii a couple years later. And that was in 2009 when I bought my first property in Hawaii. And I was there for actually 2 years right during the crash. And so I just put in a lot of offers over a 2 year period while I was there. And I knew that, you know, people were dropping the price. I could just watch it go down and down. And so I figured I could just take my time and put in a lot of offers. And finally, right before I was stationed or getting ready to go on orders to leave Hawaii, I picked up a rental property there right on the water. And I got a great deal on that one as well. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so when you first started, when you were in El Paso, when you bought that first rental, were you renting yourself at that point?
Yeah, actually, the first year I rented that first property that I bought out myself. And I just Googled, you know, lease online and found a copy of a lease and signed it. But the great thing was that I was in a huge military area. There's a huge base, Fort Bliss there, that they were expanding. And so I figured it's a great place to buy a rental since a lot more soldiers are going to be coming in. And so I rented it to a soldier. And, you know, I screened them pretty well. Obviously, you know, you have to, you're pre-screened going into the Army somewhat. And so it worked out well. And then when I left there, I got a professional property manager.
But as far as like where you were actually living, like were you living on base or were you renting yourself when you bought that investment property?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. When we first got down there, me and a couple buddies and I from West Point, we partnered up on purchasing a property fresh out of college, and they were, you know, they're giving away loans at 7-Eleven at that time, you know,
mm-hmm. Right.
30-year loan. So we went in together and bought a house, which was right across from this rental. So
okay,
my one buddy bought it under his credit, you know, it was under his name, but we decided we'd split it three ways. And so a year later, we sold that house and, we actually split the profit three ways and it sold for like $30,000 more a year later.
That's awesome. Wow.
It was crazy at that time. But then moved into a different property. I bought a different property and moved into it. So I kept renting the first one that I bought, and I moved into a second one that I bought.
Okay. Now, tell me about renting to military people, because I think that is a really great way to go, because you know that they have a job and they're going to be able to pay you. But if they don't pay you, can't you call their supervisor and get them in trouble? Is that true? I've heard that before. I don't know if that's exactly right.
Yeah, it absolutely is true. Okay. I used to be the supervisor that answered those calls when my soldiers didn't pay the rent. So yeah, you can. And there's, you know, there's a lot of benefits to it as well, as far as getting it rented, because there's a website at each I think it's a website that's nationwide, but you can narrow the search down to whatever post or base you're near, and you can post your rental on there for soldiers that are coming in.
Okay.
So it's a great way to get it rented out quickly as well. So it's a good strategy.
Yeah. I know the military is always moving people around. Is your turnover constant, or do people tend to stay there for a year or two before they move on?
Yeah. If it's stateside, typically they're there at least 3 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So if it's overseas, it's shorter tours, but usually stateside at least 3 years.
Wow. Okay. That's perfect. I mean, I think anyone would be happy with a tenant staying 3 years. So that's perfect. Now, how many properties do you have in El Paso right now?
I've got two in El Paso.
Okay. Okay. And you have a property manager down there that takes care of everything?
I do. Yeah. He's a retired first sergeant from the Army, and he stayed there, and he's got a realty brokerage and a property management company, and he runs it very military-like, and it operates very well.
Perfect. And then in Hawaii, I assume you have a manager out there too, right? Right.
Yes. And I actually found that manager because I was renting while I was in Hawaii, and they did a great job screening me and did a great job following up on repairs, and they were just very thorough. So it was just very natural for me to use them once I bought a place.
And so then, I guess, when you got out of the military, then you moved to Chicago?
So the way I was buying rentals when I was in the service is I was approved for conventional financing, you know, 30-year mortgages, because I had a W-2 income. And so, you know, you could rent something out, get it stabilized for a year, and then use that income from the rental to report as, you know, income on your, you know, when you're applying for your next mortgage. And so I would just do that. And so when I got back to Chicago, I actually was on terminal leave. I had a bunch of leave saved up. And so I had a few months where I was still collecting a paycheck. And so I was able to buy another rental using another 30-year mortgage when I got back to Chicago, right downtown on Lakeshore Drive. And that was prior to starting my fix and flip business.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. So today your primary business is you buy houses, you fix them up, and you sell them. Now, just being in that business and coming across a lot of deals, is that where you're finding your rentals today? Are they houses that you decided to keep instead of flip?
Yeah, exactly. It's so nice to have different strategies. It's much, I think, easier to get into rentals. It's more forgiving in a lot of ways to get into rentals than flipping. It's a little more high stakes, higher cost of money, you know, that time, extremely time sensitive. So, you know, it's a little bit tougher to learn that strategy, but knowing both, we'll do a lot of marketing, and, you know, we'll put up signs or we'll send out direct mailers. And when calls come in, you know, sometimes it's not a good flip area, but it's a perfect cash flow area. So we'll sometimes wholesale it, or we'll sometimes buy it as a rental ourselves.
Okay. Now, as far as owning the properties, you're using your self-directed IRA to hold a lot of the rentals today. Is it a lot of the rentals, or are you just doing a few of them in your IRA?
It's a newer strategy for me that I just self-directed my IRA about a year and a half ago. But I just love the concept of, you know, not losing any purchasing power when you do a flip, or you buy a rental property and you're collecting that rent. You're not paying any tax on it. It's going right back into that self-directed and just growing that pot. And it forces you to save it too. You know, you don't spend that cash flow. It goes right into your retirement.
Now, I know there's a ton of rules with the self-directed IRA. Like, what are some things that people should watch out for to make sure you don't get in trouble? Because I guess there would be a huge tax consequence if you didn't do something right. What are some of the gotchas that people should watch out for?
Right. Yeah. If you Google it, there's all these articles about warnings and stuff and that you have to be very careful, which is true. You know, you do. The main rule that you have to be aware of is that your IRA cannot benefit you or a direct descendant family member, like a parent or your child or your spouse in any way. Mm-hmm. Until you retire, right? So it's totally separate account. It's a separate entity in itself. And any investments that you make through your self-directed IRA or any money that comes out of it, it comes from your self-directed IRA. And then any proceeds or rent collection, or when you sell a property, the proceeds that, you know, all the profit from it, it goes right back in your self-directed IRA. And so there's a custodian that manages that account, and they direct all of the funds so that you never touch the funds. You know, nothing is ever sent to me personally. It's sent from my self-directed IRA to the seller, or to, you know, pay for a bill, you know, an electric bill. It's sent from my self-directed IRA to the electric company. And I'm not ever a middleman.
Okay. So when the tenant pays their rent, are they sending it directly into the IRA company?
Exactly.
Okay. Yep. So you're not even involved. And then you have a manager then that manages it, or can you manage it yourself?
You know, they recommend having a manager. You can manage yourself, but you just cannot do any of the work yourself.
Okay. So if something breaks, you have a refrigerator break, you've got to send over a repair person, you can't actually write the check to them. Your IRA custodian has to actually mail that check to the service. Okay.
There you can set up an LLC, and it's called a checkbook IRA, that, you know, your self-directed IRA is basically owned under the LLC. And so it's like your self-directed IRA is writing that check then. I found, you know, it's just more expense and more fees. And so what I've found is just easier to just direct. You can log into your portal and say, you know, for this asset that I own under my self-directed IRA, write the check to the electric company or whatever, and they'll direct it and send it right to them.
Oh, okay. Okay. Now, can you get financing on an IRA, or do you have to have the cash in there to buy properties?
Yeah, that's the other great thing, which, you know, and this is the part that's, it seems like it's, it wouldn't be legal, but you can actually leverage your IRA and get financing for an asset. The only caveat is that it needs to be a non-recourse loan, which means that the lender can't come back after you if there's a default. So typically the leverage is going to be much lower on a non-recourse loan because there's no retribution if you default on the loan.
Right. Okay. Well, I think that's an interesting strategy. How many properties do you have in your IRA right now?
I just have one. Okay. One rental in my IRA, but I also, the cool thing about self-directed too is that you can invest in anything. I mean, you could wholesale a property from your IRA as long as the name of your IRA is on the contract. All the proceeds from the wholesale go right back into your IRA. So you never even own the property. So there's all kinds of creative things you can do with it. One of them, another thing that I'm doing with mine is I have a small loan out to a friend who is starting a business. And so I own equity in his business. And so, you know, if the business blows up and takes off and, you know, that's paid out eventually, all that money would come back in tax-free to my IRA.
And that is a real great way to just blow up your IRA. I mean, if you're adding a couple of $1,000 a year into an account and you're putting it in the stock market and it goes up 5% or whatever, it's going to take you forever to amass any kind of real wealth there. But if you can wholesale a deal or invest in a business and you can get a huge hit, like that's just a great way to kind of put your IRA on steroids.
Yeah, it's awesome. And yeah, the limit is 5,500 of contributions a year, but you can make as much as you make, you know, as
long as you find your investment. So let's talk about how you're finding your deals. So like, what are you doing? Are you looking in the MLS to find deals, or are you? I know you said you do a lot of marketing. Are you finding your rentals through the marketing, or were there houses that just maybe don't make sense to flip and you're keeping?
Yeah. So it's changed over the years. We started our fix and flip company about 4.5 years ago. And it was really because I always wanted to be in rentals. You know, I know that that's long-term the way to build wealth. But once I didn't qualify for financing anymore, it was kind of like, this is a good way to raise capital. So, so we started about 4.5 years ago. And at that time in 2011, you could buy off the MLS pretty easily. So, you know, the main source of our deals at that time were coming from the MLS, with, you know, not a crazy amount of negotiation. Over the years, it's definitely changed, and the MLS is much more competitive these days. So we're doing a lot more direct mail. We're sending yellow letters to, non-owner occupied houses. And then we're also doing, signs. You know, we do the roadside signs, and that's been a great strategy because those sellers are actually very motivated when they call from signs. So you don't have to screen through a lot of calls to find somebody who's motivated. It's most of the calls are motivated sellers.
And are those just banded signs that say "We buy houses" and have your phone number?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Wow. And so when someone calls off those signs, is somebody answering the phone, or do you have it go to a voicemail and then call them back when you have time?
Yeah, it's, I've got Google Voice on my phone. So it goes to my cell phone. If I'm available, I'll answer because it's always better to talk to them directly.
Sure.
Somebody's very motivated to sell. I want to talk to them when they're motivated.
Right.
But I've also got a good voicemail set up on there that if I can't, it just goes to voicemail and I call them back when I'm free. And you know, with those signs, you're not getting 1,000 calls a day. It's typically, you know, we'll put them up on the weekend and get 3, 4, 5 calls a day. And so it's very easy to manage.
Okay. Now, if someone is looking to get started, they want to buy their first rental, what would you tell them or what would you recommend they do for their very first step to get started?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the thing I like about real estate is that there are so many different strategies, from, you know, all the different marketing strategies to the different financing strategies to, you know, what your exit strategy is going to be. So if you just want a rental, the first step I would say is analyze the areas, and you really got to decide between, do you want cash flow or do you want appreciation? Because when I was buying in Hawaii, I knew that I'm going to buy in a place where there's, you know, an assessment on this condo and there's not going to be a huge amount of cash flow, but it's also appreciated, you know, quite a bit over the years. So it was kind of a trade-off there. And I knew I was going to hold it long-term. Now I like the idea of cash flow more, you know, and so I'm buying in more working class areas where you can buy rentals extremely cheap and the rents are still high. And actually the one that I own in my self-directed IRA is a Section 8 property. And I really like Section 8. I know there's a lot of horror stories and we've had bad experiences actually from some other Section 8 properties that we've owned, but I've kind of learned how to manage that process over the years as well.
Do you, and you manage those yourself, the Section 8 properties?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. I won't ever use a property manager for Section 8 again.
Okay. And why is that? Because they're just maybe not on top of the tenants as much as they need to be.
Yeah, exactly. I've never been able to find, we've screened a lot of property managers, and the issue with Section 8 is it seems like there's this enormous cash flow and you just sit back and collect it, but it is extremely management intensive. And so you really have to screen hard the tenants and you know who you're renting to. And then also you have to be there and you have to be around and be present and check on the property. It's not like a high-end property where you can rent it and probably it's very little wear on the property and, you know, you'll get your rent most likely. It's you have to just be there to make sure that the house is being kept up and, you know, all the details are being adhered to. And I just haven't found a property manager.
Okay. Now, those Section 8 properties, a lot of times you're right, they do have just really incredible cash flow, much more than you're going to get in another property. But those tenants seem more likely to damage the property. And like you said, you have to be more involved. At the end of the day, do you feel like you're actually netting more money with the extra time it takes and with the extra damage you're going to have?
What I've learned over the years is that it all depends on if you're buying the right property. So the first Section 8 property we bought was a 3-unit. We didn't know the area real well. We found out that this is one of the most violent corners of this area. It's a south suburb of Chicago, a near south suburb that, you know, it's not, the suburb itself isn't terrible, but this particular street block in this corner is really bad. There's a lot of drug activity and stuff. And so, you know, I don't buy multi-unit Section 8s anymore because you just have a concentrated amount of people there that are high management intensive. Mm-hmm. And so I will buy single family Section 8. And I also don't buy them in areas where I wouldn't feel comfortable walking around and feel comfortable in. So, you know, now I'm buying them in the south suburbs still, but a little bit further south, where the houses are spread out a little more in like a decent neighborhood area. And I'm buying the single family homes, and I'm buying like the one that I recently bought is it was built in 1970s, no basement, just a 1,000 square foot, 3-bedroom, 1-bath home. Very, like if it was just absolutely rock starred and destroyed, I could go in there and pretty much fix it up for a maximum of $20,000-$30,000 and have, you know, most of it all, you know, fixed. So,
right. Okay.
So you got to buy the right property, and kind of know what you're doing there.
Awesome. Well, Kirby, if someone wants to reach out to you or if they want to sell you their house for 50 cents on the dollar, what's the best way to reach out to you?
Yeah, absolutely. If you go to iCandy Homes, it's the letter I, CandyHomes. It's kind of like the iPhone. iCandyHomes.com. That's our website. It's a seller's website. You can put the information in there, and we'd love to take a look at the property.
Sounds good. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Kirby, and thank you for listening. My name is Dan Lane, and this has been the Rental Income Podcast.